Lounge, 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. There's new information about the 5 days that passed between the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City and the arrest of his suspected killer, Luigi Mangione, in Altoona, Pennsylvania. ABC's Ike Giacci has more.
The FBI is saying it received a tip about the identity of the suspect from police in San Francisco 4 days after the shooting. NYPD confirming that message wasn't appropriately prioritized.
Authorities in New York say they believe Mangione might drop his fight against extradition. He remains in custody in Pennsylvania. President-elect Donald Trump said on social media that Republicans will do everything in their power to end daylight saving time. He'll attend the Army-Navy football game today. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi remains in a hospital in Luxembourg. The 84-year-old suffered a hip injury after she fell on a congressional trip. She'll require surgery. This is ABC News. People in Syria enjoying the freedom that comes with the collapse of the Assad government. ABC's James Longman in Syria said there are new revelations almost daily about what the Assad regime was up to.
Discoveries about his tyrannical rule mount. We found proof of the drug-dealing business that helped keep him in power. The banned stimulant, Captagon, helped fund his lavish lifestyle and the corruption that secured his allegiance with Hezbollah and Iran. And across town, one of the most notorious Syrian intelligence divisions. Dozens of files still intact, each one assigned to a person the regime had spied on. Assad ruled through paranoia, those who worked for the state in almost as much danger as the rest of his people.
Pro Football Hall of Famer Randy Moss announced Friday he's being treated for cancer. The 47-year-old, considered one of the greatest wide receivers in history, announced that he had underwent surgery to remove a cancerous mass in his bile duct. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Here's a community reminder for you from the Buzz of the North. The Hayward Community Food Shelf is available for you each first Saturday of the month. Located at the Hayward Community Food Shelf at 16216 U.S. Highway 63 in Hayward. Again, the food shelf is available the first Saturday of the month from 9 a.m. until 12 noon. Another community reminder for you from the Buzz of the North.
Quiet down. Here she comes.
Shh.
Surprise! Your accountant just emailed to say your quarterly taxes are way higher than you were expecting.
At Progressive, we know small business owners don't usually like surprises because they cost you money. But a good surprise that could save you money? Getting discounts with a commercial auto quote from Progressive.
Also, your favorite employee is leaving. They're going to pursue their dream of being a veterinarian.
Surprise yourself. See if you can save in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at BuzzOfTheNorth.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Even though it's illegal under state law, more Wisconsinites are getting abortion care through telemedicine. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
An 1800s Wisconsin law caused a temporary statewide ban on abortion services after Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. But Jenny Higgins with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Collaborative for Reproductive Equity says even after the ban was lifted in 2023, demand for abortion pills in Wisconsin remained high.
Suggesting that even when brick and mortar facilities are offering abortion care in our state, telehealth abortion still is a really important service that many people in our state are taking advantage of through these Shield laws.
There have been about 130 orders for abortion pills per month made through Shield Law providers since July of 2023, according to WeCount data. There have also been reports of stockpiling nationwide since the election. With only 4 abortion clinics statewide, 96% of Wisconsin counties don't have an abortion provider, and about 70% of Wisconsinites of reproductive age live in a county without an abortion clinic. Higgins says while Shield Law clinicians provide critical and affordable care to Wisconsinites who grapple with numerous restrictions to abortion, attempts to criminalize both providers and patients are expected, with Black and brown patients at the highest risk.
And we know historically that Black and brown women are the most likely to be criminalized during pregnancy, whether that pregnancy is ending in abortion or birth. And so I think we need to pay great attention to the ways in which some of the pregnant people with the least social power could be putting themselves at risk.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Northern Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Slight chance of snow this afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy with a high near 30 degrees. Southeast winds up to 25 miles per hour. Winds gust to 20 on your Saturday night. Chance of snow and freezing rain, and temperatures right around 30 degrees. Sunday cloudy, 37.
Right now, it's 22.
Dom Selvia.
I'm Jimmy Cuska filling in for Dom Selvia. Coming up Monday, we'll talk gas prices heading into the holidays, and it's not too late to run for local office. We'll tell you how.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this, the second hour of our discussion of all things law-related here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, Max and I are taking your inquiries and your questions through our phone line at 855-952-4842, or you can also drop one of those questions or inquiries into the Civic Media app, and we will get to that as well. And indeed, one of our frequent callers, Mark, is on the line right now. Mark, appreciate your calling in to our weekend broadcast with your comment, your question, or observation about the law in America today. Mark, glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, considering, you know, and I've said this before, but considering the fact that the January 6th thing was intimately tied to the fake elector thing, because it was part of the whole Wisconsin sweep plot that they had, because they had a way, you know, not only to get the fake electors in place to take those fake votes, that they also had a plot to get those votes to the Vice President of the United States. And the January 6th insurrection riot, whatever you want to call it, was just part of the plan to delay things so much that they could get those fake elector ballots into the Vice President if he would accept them, and introduce them into to the floor of our House, you know, during the vote. I mean, that is just so the whole thing is just ridiculous that you know, Jim Troupas is saying you've ruined my life. Well, Jim Troupas and his co-conspirators, you know, the two other men he is charged with in this, you know, committing fraud against the people who said, well, they took his advice. Well, if you take illegal advice, if you take bad advice, that is no excuse from the fact that you actually violated the law. Your responsibility is that to actually understand what you are actually doing as an elector and follow the Constitution, because the Constitution is clear, as I've said many times before, that it is the people of the electors. We, the voters, you know, they're called, you know, it's two different terms there, that we select the electors of the President of the United States. And they upended that. They violated each and every citizen of the state of Wisconsin's rights to have their votes recognized, whether you voted for Donald Trump or Joe Biden back in 2020.
And that's exactly right.
Were violated,
and
when that
Mark,
happened.
I could not agree more. And indeed, that is quite literally the subject of our next discussion item here on our broadcast, including this commentary about what has happened. And as you've just indicated so well, Mark, things we've talked about before, this notion of personal responsibility and understanding, based upon common sense, what you are doing. If indeed you are filling out, you are signing off on under penalty of perjury a statement that indicates that not only are you an elector from the state of your residence, but that you are signing off on a popular vote result that you know is not true, That's a false statement, right? And you are not a victim of a crime. You are actually a criminal. And so let's get to that very story that Mark introduces at the top of this, our second hour here on Amicus, a law review. Because once again, fake electors in the news, not just here in Wisconsin, but around the country once again, much related to this issue of pardons and what happened on January 6th. And indeed, even before that, we know well that in the 2024 election that just concluded, we are actually now going to be electing our president next week, Tuesday, the 17th of December, is when the electors from around our nation, including right here in Wisconsin, get together and vote. And vote as electors. They're going to be deciding who the next president is, presumably granting Donald Trump enough electoral votes to be opened on January 6th of 2025 by the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate. Those people are Mike Johnson and, of course, Kamala Harris. And they will do what is constitutionally mandated of them to do, which is to review the votes being issued and being voted on this coming week. What happened just this past week that has an impact upon that past election in 2020? Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call filing 10 additional felony charges against two attorneys. Mark's got it just right. Two attorneys and an aide who worked for, at that time, then-President Donald Trump, over their roles in a plan to submit this false paperwork, these false electors claiming that Donald Trump had won Wisconsin, when in fact, we know he did not. Those additional charges filed just this past week, they go into a circuit court. That's a state court, not the federal court. Dane County Circuit Court against Ken Chesbrough, who is a Wisconsin native. He was the lead architect of the 2020 electoral scheme. Also, as Mark just indicated, former Dane County Judge Jim Troupis, T-R-O-U-P-I-S, represented Donald Trump in Wisconsin during the 2020 election. And also the third defendant who continues in this package, this group of people charged in our state system, a fellow named Mike Roman. He's a former Trump aide, allegedly delivered, as Mark just said, the Wisconsin false elector documents, the paperwork, to a Pennsylvania congressman staffer to get them to the vice president on January 6th. The additional charges here, and this is why this is so very interesting, as Mark has just alluded to, and I will underscore, the additional charges now, the initial charge, of course, single charges to each one of them, a felony forgery charge filed early this year against Chesbrough and Troupis and Roman, and they, of course, appeared on those this past Thursday, also appearing based upon the new charges. And this is what is so interesting, both intellectually and also a head-scratcher. The additional charges, again, brought by our attorney general, allege forgery, again, to defraud whom? The Republican electors themselves, who cast their ballots for Trump in 2020, even though, again, Joe Biden decisively won the state. Mark just capsulized it as best as anyone can, and that is that we are now turning here. The people who should have been charged with crimes a long time ago, we're now 4 years out, and we're now charging, again, the architects. Undeniably, they are responsible, the Chesbroughs and Troupises and Romans of the world here and in other places, responsible for putting this together. But also responsible are the people who actually signed off on those false documents. They are not charged here in the state of Wisconsin. Our attorney general has previously issued a memorandum to the Wisconsin Election Commission stating that, in his view, they committed no crimes, at least no crimes under the election laws, and therefore nothing to be seen here. Just this past week, effectively reaffirming that position and saying that they actually were defrauded themselves. And while that may be supported by their own defense, that is that they say that they didn't consent, they were misled, they were duped into doing all these kinds of things, I would argue, as Mark just did, as many others have argued, that that defense should be presented, if at all, to a jury in the course of a criminal proceeding. It flies in the face of common sense that when you have in front of you a document asked to sign and that you do sign, and you are told that, well, this is going to be used arguably in case we get a court to overturn what you know is just been established by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Hours earlier, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reaffirmed the results of that 2020 election, Joe Biden beating Donald Trump by about 21,000 votes in Wisconsin. And the state Supreme Court upheld the results on December 14th of 2020. And so as a result of all of that, you've got a very strong case that the electors themselves engage knowingly and purposefully in conduct, signing off on those documents, representing that they're something other than who they are, representing something other than what happened here in the state of Wisconsin, and presumably not a big jump of intellectual power to come to the conclusion that they knew what they were doing and participated in the very scheme as co-conspirators, as co-defendants, along with the architects. Nonetheless, our attorney general this past week identifying them now as victims of the fraud committed against them by the three. Interesting development as this goes forward. We know, of course, that that theory advanced by our attorney general just this past week, contrary to what the attorneys general and all the other states have done, we know that the electors themselves, unlike here in the state of Wisconsin, have in fact been criminally charged in state and federal courts where? In Arizona, in Michigan, in Georgia, in Nevada. And indeed, according to the federal government, we're also, before the entire federal case collapsed recently, they were also identified as being potential defendants, at least being reviewed, according to Lisa Monaco, the deputy attorney general, for potential criminal federal responsibility by the Department of Justice. All of this also happens in a time when in Nevada, just the opposite undertaken by the attorney general there, Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford, F-O-R-D, this past week charged six individuals with submitting falsified documents to Congress, declaring President Donald Trump the winner of the key swing state, that is the state of Nevada, in 2020. Now you say, well, didn't he already do that? The answer is yes. He did this previously and indeed identified them previously. They're in Nevada for having engaged in criminal conduct. And a judge there found that that initial indictment in Clark County there in that state, it was invalid because the prosecutor, according to the judge, had filed that in the wrong venue, the wrong district, if you will. Not because the substance of the charges was wrong, but because they were in the wrong place. Now, the Nevada Attorney General, Aaron Ford, pursuing an appeal of that, but he says, while that is going on, while I'm pursuing that appeal, I'm also going to double down. I'm going to reaffirm, even while we disagree with what the judge has done there, we're going to reaffirm the criminality, the charged criminality of the electors there in the state of Nevada for doing what they did. He said, while we disagree with the finding of improper venue and will continue to seek to overturn it, we are preserving our legal rights to ensure that these fake electors do not escape justice. That's what the attorney general in Nevada said this past week. The actions of the fake electors that they undertook in 2020 violated state criminal law and were direct attempts to both sow doubt in our democracy and undermine the results of a free and fair election. The attorney general, state of Nevada, saying that justice requires that these actions not go unpunished. Very clear articulation by another state, like the other states, with the exception of Wisconsin, that have viewed the electors themselves as criminals who should be brought to justice. We live in a time, obviously, when judgments appropriately, as always, made by prosecutors based upon evidence, based upon the facts of the law. Outstanding, of course, are the resolutions of many of these cases. All of them, we hasten to add, presumed innocent until proven guilty by a beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury unanimously determining their guilt or their innocence. Fake electors, once again, in the news here in Wisconsin and throughout the nation this past week, having to do with the election of 2020, even as next week we anticipate that electors will once again to get together in Wisconsin and in all the other places and properly vote for the actual person who won the election, won the campaign, won the popular vote in their states. As we continue, we're going to talk more about another state case, this one in Manhattan in the state of New York, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Freezing your credit sounds drastic, but it's not. In fact, freezing your credit is one of the best ways you can protect yourself from identity theft. Freezing your credit doesn't stop your credit score from going up or down. It's just a way to make sure that nobody can open an account in your name, not even you, without removing your freeze first. So to freeze your credit, you just contact each of the three major credit bureaus and you request a credit freeze. Just search up the term credit freeze and you'll find the phone numbers and websites where you can get it all done. And don't worry, you can always unfreeze your credit when you need to apply for new credit, like a loan or something, by contacting each bureau again. For more money tips, check out workmoney.org or text money, M-O-N-E-Y, to 88285. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying take good care.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
This is Amicus Solar Review. We are continuing with our review, our discussion, our analysis of the news of these recent days in state courts and federal courts, things coming out of the White House, things coming out of our tribunals across our nation and states in particular, including Manhattan. You may recall that earlier this year, in May of this year, after a 7-week trial that riveted the nation, riveted the face of the planet, the first time in our nation's history when a former president, and yes, at that time, a candidate for the presidency, he is going to be our next president, reviewed by a jury and determined by that jury unanimously to have violated 34 different counts of New York law, having to do with false statements, false representations, record keeping with respect to false representations about the reasons why he gave, that is, Donald Trump gave monies to his fixer, his attorney, Michael Cohen, and representations falsely to indicate that that was for legal services, when in fact we know that was hush money. That's why the case is sometimes called the hush money case, to keep people quiet about prior sexual events involving the, at that time, 2016, a candidate for the presidency, Donald Trump. In the wake of all of those trial proceedings, jury returns a verdict finding Donald Trump unanimously guilty of those offenses as charged in the case against him. And since that time, Donald Trump has not been sentenced. Initially, and presumably to this day, the presiding judge, his name is Justice, they call them justices there, his name is Juan Merchan, has postponed that sentencing in part because he wanted to determine whether or not that catastrophic ruling on July 1, to which I made reference earlier, that catastrophic ruling finding that sitting presidents have immunities for crimes committed in office, well, that applies to the offense conduct and the trial of that offense conduct in his courtroom in Manhattan back in May. The answer to that is clear. It should be clear. It's already been articulated by a federal judge who said, no, there's nothing about this case that is official in nature. The defendant at the time was not the president. Nothing about paying off a porn star to keep quiet about a sexual liaison that you've had that is an official conduct, a piece of the responsibility given to you as a president, a candidate for the presidency. It's ridiculous, the federal judge decided, in rejecting Donald Trump's attempt to take that case from state court into federal court. Juan Merchan has before him, ever since then, ever since July 1, the same question, and has failed to this point to make that equally clear and determinative decision. We're still waiting on that decision from Justice Juan Merchan. It should not be this difficult. Along the way, he has postponed the sentencing, first in July, then into September, then just a few weeks ago, right before the Thanksgiving holiday. And on that time, right about the time of the Thanksgiving holiday, basically taking all of this off his calendar in the wake of Donald Trump's election as our next president. And so, although we have not heard from Juan Merchan ever since that decision to take all these matters off of his docket, the case is still pending. The case is still pending this weekend and presumably in the days ahead until he does something as the presiding judge. The case is not an appeal. It has not yet been dismissed. It is still on his docket. And the things that he needs to do are two. He needs, number one, to redress and resolve this issue about whether or not there is any sense in which the Supreme Court's opinion precludes him from going ahead. The answer should be no. That should not be a difficult issue. Other judges, other jurists, other people looking at these things dispassionately have said they do not apply. It's probably the one case, among the three or four here where there is clearly no applicability at all. And yet he has failed to do that up to this point. And again, declined to sentence and declined to do the fundamental thing that we do in America. Any state court defendant, any federal court defendant, as a part of the process, gets sentenced. That's a part of the expectation of our process on behalf of the public, that the courts serve, that judges serve. Frankly, it is a right that the public has. It is a right that the defendant has also to the disposition, a speedy trial, a speedy disposition of her, his, or its case. That's also ground into our very constitutional principles, the very ways in which we do things. And yet, although a verdict was entered, a judgment was returned by that jury way back in May. Coming up now, 6 months afterwards, we still don't have a sentencing. And so just this past week, just in recent days, the district attorney there, his name, of course, is Alvin Bragg, who prosecuted that case successfully through his colleagues there in the court, the Manhattan Criminal Court in New York City. Alvin Bragg has done a couple of things. One, straightforward. One, very curious, once again. He's filed another motion saying, you know what? You should not dismiss this case, Judge. There's no such thing, he said, as president-elect immunity. He said this court should reject Trump's motion to immediately dismiss the indictment, vacate the jury's jury verdict simply based upon the outcome of the recent presidential election. There are no grounds for such an action to be undertaken. President-elect immunity does not exist. Even if you think somehow that the Supreme Court case affects the sitting president, which is what they talked about, he says, no, it doesn't affect a president-elect and doesn't affect a private citizen. He's absolutely right about that, of course. That has been his position from the start. But the other interesting thing that comes out of just this past week is this flurry of discussions and representations about the options now in front of Judge Juan Merchan. And there's one in particular that caught my attention. I suspect it caught yours because it underscores how this entire process is now being turned on its head. That instead of doing what every other criminal defendant in America, in Wisconsin, in New York, in California, in Florida, in Texas, in Hawaii, should expect, what the people should expect, that is after the return of a guilty verdict and the administration, the resolving of any post-trial motions by a presiding judge, we proceed to sentencing. And the sentencing, much like the pardon authority, if you will, is pretty much subject to, at least at that level, the discretion of the sentencing judge, who takes into account all kinds of things, not only the offense conduct, but where the defendant comes from, his or her history, the background, the reasons why he or she did the things that he has done or she has done, the sense of contrition, all kinds of other things, even conduct that's unrelated to the offense conduct. The judge has the capacity to take all those aggravating and, yes, indeed, mitigating factors in place and impose sentence. And that's what Judge Merchan needs to do now. In the month or so before the president-elect becomes the president, he's got the capacity to do it. A sentencing proceeding could indeed take perhaps a day. The defendant has the right to what's called allocution. You can talk to the judge about what you think should happen. The prosecution has an opportunity to speak to the judge as well. Defense counsel have the opportunity to do it. And after the judge hears from everybody, announces a sentence. This is not a trial. This does not take weeks. For what it's worth, we know that the president-elect was in not too far from the Manhattan Criminal Court just this past week in appearing at the New York Stock Exchange, doing other things there in New York. This is the time, if ever, when his presidency would not be interrupted by imposing a sentence, following which, during the course of the years yet to come, appellate proceedings could proceed. Donald Trump does not have to be a part of the appellate proceedings in person, doesn't have to appear in the New York Appellate Court, the New York Supreme Court. Not even the United States Supreme Court, if it should get that far. That can go on while he is president without in any way affecting the day-to-day operation of the presidency. And the reason why that's important is because all these policies inside the Department of Justice, all the reasons why people are advocating for the dismissal of this case is because of the impact that it would reportedly have upon the presidency itself, the operation of the executive.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt Nair on Air.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. There's new information about the 5 days that passed between the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City and the arrest of his suspected killer, Luigi Mangione, in Altoona, Pennsylvania. ABC's Ike Ajachi has more.
The FBI is saying it received a tip about the identity of the suspect from police in San Francisco 4 days after the shooting. NYPD confirming that message wasn't appropriately prioritized.
Authorities in New York say they believe Mangione might drop his fight against extradition. He remains in custody in Pennsylvania. President-elect Donald Trump said on social media that Republicans will do everything in their power to end daylight saving time. He'll attend the Army-Navy football game today. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi remains in a hospital in Luxembourg. The 84-year-old suffered a hip injury after she fell on a congressional trip. She'll require surgery. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
A win for Badgers volleyball. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin women's volleyball team came back last night to eliminate Texas A&M 3-2 in the NCAA regionals. The Badgers will play Nebraska Sunday at 2 p.m. carried on ABC TV. The Cornhuskers beat the Badgers twice during a regular season. NBA, the Bucks and the Atlanta Hawks today in the NBA Cup semifinals as the tournament gets underway in Las Vegas. Baseball, the Brewers say it's a good deal. They traded away closer Devin Williams to the New York Yankees in exchange for two players, left-handed pitcher Nestor Cortez, infielder Caleb During, and for cash consideration. The 30-year-old Williams was with the Brewers for 6 years. NFL, Packers headed to Seattle to face the Seahawks tomorrow night. Defensive back Jair Alexander, still dealing with a knee injury, was not at practice yesterday.
Why wasn't he there?
Just based on what I saw over the last couple days, didn't feel like he's ready to play.
So will he be out then this week?
Yeah.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Northern Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Slight chance of snow this afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy with a high near 30 degrees. Southeast winds up to 25 miles per hour. Winds gust to 20 on your Saturday night. Chance of snow and freezing rain, and temperatures right around 30 degrees. Sunday cloudy, 37.
It's 24 right now.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
The Todd Alba Show.
We're going to meet each other out in beautiful Seattle. My youngest godson lives out there. He works for the Navy at the Bremerton Naval Shipyard.
This is like your trip to L.A. There's always a connection over here.
Well, sure, because there's no hotel costs. I crash on people's couches. Right?
You are as innovative as you are cheap. That's a beautiful thing. You are correct. Thrifty, my friend. Are you sure Todd's a former Republican? Yes. Yes, he is.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey K., Professor Emeritus of Democracy. We're talking about the Act 10 overturned by a Dane County judge.
I think it's important for everyone to know that this was the state that in 1959 first granted public employees the right to organize and bargain collectively. We have a lot to take back. You know, I used to say take back America, but I say take back Wisconsin.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
The first time seeing my son, I feel like my life did a 180. He really a definition of like why he loves somebody.
Through all of fatherhood's firsts, never stop being a dad. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk about news deserts and what that means to our politics. We'll wrap it all up with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. I hope you can join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are continuing our discussion about state court cases, state court criminal cases, the one in Wisconsin, our attorney general announcing 10 additional charges against the architects of the fake electors scheme, but not the fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin, and now discussing what happens to our president-elect and the disposition of the case pending against him for a long time, including many months during which the presiding judge, Juan Merchan, has not imposed sentence, not resolved pretrial matters about the applicability of this immunity decision to the case. And so the attorney general this past weekend in recent times in a number of pleadings has said you've got a number of options. He said, do not dismiss this case. No reason to do it. Nothing about that Supreme Court case prompts that. He says that there should be some accommodation that opens him up to some other options, all of which are somewhat peculiar. One in particular, especially peculiar, he has proposed in the past that these proceedings simply be halted while Donald Trump is in office and that they be resumed, the file taken off the bench, if you will, off the file cabinet, if you will, sometime in 2029. And then Donald Trump is sentenced for the offense conduct that was entered, the judgment entered against him in May of 2024. He proposed that halt the proceedings while Donald Trump is in office and do nothing. He has plainly advocated, again, that the case should not be dismissed. There should be no dismissal of this based upon improper evidence during the course of the trial, again, premised upon the decision by the Supreme Court about immunity. So he's taken the line once again that president-elect immunity doesn't exist. The case should not be dismissed, but perhaps it should be suspended. Some accommodation should be given. But now something else, another possibility that is also identified, and that is, hold on, treat Donald Trump as if he has died. If the judge wants to do more than halt Donald Trump's case while he is in office, the prosecutors have said, they proposed a novel alternative, treating Donald Trump as if he is dead. Reading this, it makes sense to borrow from the manner in which courts address abatement, A-B-A-T-E-M-E-N-T, it's a legal term, because many of defendants' arguments here parallel the arguments made in favor of dismissal upon a defendant's death. That's what Alvin Bragg is telling the court just this past week. That scenario would terminate the prosecution without formally tossing the jury's guilty verdict. So it has that going for it, if you will, but little else. The court would presumably update the case file to note that the verdict is removed from the presumption of innocence, that that remains, the decision of the jury removing the presumption of evidence of innocence here, that remains in place, and basically establishing that Donald Trump was never sentenced. His conviction was neither affirmed nor reversed on appeal. Everything kind of frozen in place, almost as if the defendant has died. Prosecutors, including Alvin Bragg, say that this very, very novel thing, this approach, would be a first of its kind, presumably in the history of our nation, but told the judge to at least be justified in exploring it. Again, the DA saying, especially given the novelty of defendants' own immunity claims, it would hardly be improper for this court to exercise its inherent authority to consider very novel remedies. And my answer, my thought in response to this is, why are we doing all of these gymnastic backflips to try to accomplish something that is very easily understood, a part of the process? And that is the fifth, or arguably the sixth, alternative on all these lists of things that Juan Merchan could do. And that is simply sentence the defendant and bring this case to a conclusion that does not prevent the appeals from going forward, the presiding judge, Juan Merchan, can very easily suspend the imposition of whatever judgment he imposes, whether it's some time in prison, whether it's probation, whether it's supervision, all kinds of things under New York law that he can do. Simply suspend that, but conclude the case now with some kind of sentencing that brings it to result. You do not have to declare the defendant dead. He is not dead. Let's not engage in these academic and legal fictions. You don't have to apply the Supreme Court case in a way that also engages in some sort of a gymnastic result that does not apply here. Facts, and events that took place in 2016, long before Donald Trump was ever the president. You don't have to do any of that. Instead, do what every other defendant, what every other defense counsel in America now anticipates, what every other prosecutor in America now anticipates, and that is that a defendant be brought finally to the resolution of his, her, its case in the trial court, and the appeal then proceeds after that. It's very simple, and it can be done, can still be done, although time is fleeting, can still be done between now and January 20th. We have yet to hear from Juan Merchan. Presumably at some point before Donald Trump does become the president, he will tell us, that is, Juan Merchan will tell us what indeed we can anticipate from his bench about the resolution of this longstanding, still unresolved case. None of these other alternatives needs to be pursued. Let's do what every other defendant, what every other criminal case anticipates in its disposition in America, and bring this case to resolution. That's the advocacy from Amicus here at Law Review on this weekend review of those state cases. Let's go back to Washington, D.C. and look again to the United States Supreme Court, where just this past week, as a result of its granting its writs of certiorari to additional cases, the docket of the Supreme Court now up to 49 cases. That includes two cases from the Seventh Circuit. It has entertained oral arguments in a number of cases in October and November, and indeed just this past week. It has also issued some recent decisions in cases. We've talked about one of those in the past, and we also know that the Supreme Court has issued an opinion just this past week in a major case affirming basically the authority of the Secretary of Homeland Security to rescind a grant of immigration status, to permit an immigrant who is seeking application to be present here in America, to rescind that. The Supreme Court has issued its opinion in a 9-0 opinion, finding that the Secretary of Homeland Security does have that capacity to rescind a prior grant of approval for an applicant for immigration status here in America. Major decision. And that case, of course, pending before the Supreme Court for a long period of time, also argued the case itself, Buarfa versus Mayorkas. Again, the question there, again, resolved 9-0 in that case, is whether or not a sham marriage determination by the secretary is a kind of thing that the secretary can consider in rescinding a decision to grant immigration legitimate legal status. The court held the Secretary of Homeland Security may, in fact, revoke an approved visa petition any time the secretary determines that there is good and sufficient cause here, finding that the facts are sufficient to do that. All justices supporting that in a unanimous decision that do sometimes happen in the Supreme Court. Case called Buarfa, B-O-U-A-R-F-I versus Mayorkas. Of course, Mayorkas is the name of the Secretary of Homeland Security. A major case, one of the two cases already decided by the Supreme Court among those 49 in its term. The Supreme Court also had oral arguments just this past week in four other cases. They had oral arguments on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. On Monday, they had oral argument, a case called Coesis, and that case involved a theory of fraudulent inducement in mail and wire fraud. It's a criminal case. On Wednesday, they had a case involving Dewberry is the name of the case, under the Lanham Act, which is a federal trademark case, a dispute between companies using the same surname. That was also a part of the oral arguments of just this past week. They've heard arguments altogether in many cases in this 2024-25 term. And once again, you can go online and hear recorded versions of those oral arguments. The Supreme Court justices battling with and engaging with the litigants in front of them, the lawyers being questioned by the judges about the merits of their cases. This past Tuesday, in a significant case called Seven County Infrastructure Coalition versus Eagle County, Colorado, it's a mouthful. It concerns the National Environmental Policy Act, and the question before the Supreme Court, argued, not yet decided, probably in May or June or July of this year, the question was whether the National Environmental Policy Act requires an agency to study environmental impacts that go well beyond what's called the proximate effect of the action over which the agency has regulatory authority. Wow, that also a lot of language here. What it basically means is, how far can environmental impact studies go? Can they go beyond the reasonable and foreseeable impacts of the thing being studied and make predictions, make speculations about the ways in which a particular event, the proximate effects of a particular event will have upon our environment? What is the breadth? What is the scope of what the EPA and what under the National Environmental Policy Act called NEPA, what can the agency do in these cases? How broad can its final report be? And it appeared that the Supreme Court in this bedrock environmental case, this bedrock environmental law, after oral argument, several of the court's conservative justices signaled that they could support at least some limits on the scope of these environmental impact studies, and that those will probably be incorporated into their decision of this coming May or June. Brett Kavanaugh, for example, argued that the courts, which have indeed struck down a lot of environmental reviews as insufficient, have taken, he said, an overly aggressive role and incentivized agencies to broaden the impact, the range of their decisions, including here whether to approve oil and gas drilling and mining projects, pipelines, logging, that go well beyond the specific focus of the inquiry. Now, the NEPA, which is the law, it requires consideration of environmental impacts before the projects are approved, and we all understand that. The results of the evaluation could, in fact, lead to mandated mitigation of environmental harms. Basically, after the study is done, you determine whether or not the proposed action, whatever it is, drilling or mining or logging, highways, all kinds of things, construction, you determine whether or not somehow that has to be mitigated to ensure environmental security in the future. At issue in this case is whether and when upstream and downstream environmental impacts, things beyond just the localized impact, should be considered as a part of these environmental reviews. And again, the court's conservative majority appeared to lean toward a lawyer who was representing one of the railway companies and the Utah counties, which is where this case comes from, who argued that the upstream and downstream effects should not be considered when they are remote in time and space, basically temporally and in terms of geography. Amy Coney Barrett raised practical concerns about the government's future ability to evaluate downstream environmental impacts in light of another law that limited the reviews to about 150 pages. She's concerned about whether or not all of this broad understanding could be encompassed in a 150-page report. Justice Sotomayor, not surprisingly, took the opposite view. She said, arguments in favor of curtailing the environmental law don't make much sense in the statutory scheme. She went on to say, most environmental effects are going to be sometimes remote in both time and geography. And so, again, you've got a split at least on the court, and it appears that perhaps there is a majority to support the challenge to NEPA and this particular understanding of how far an environmental impact study can go. Particulars of the case concern, as I suggested implicitly, a railway. It's in Utah that would ship oil. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals had said that something called the U.S. Surface Transportation Board did not adequately review the railway's environmental impact because it did not fully consider the effects of increased oil production and refining that oil, which would occur as a result beyond just the local impacts. The company behind the railway and the group of Utah counties appealed that decision, saying, no, that's wrong. You've got to localize it as to time. You've got to localize it as to geography. And they appealed that to the Supreme Court. And on behalf of the railway and the group of Utah counties, proposing kind of a two-part test instead, to determine if the environmental effects should be considered beyond just the locality of time and space. And that is whether the remoteness in time and the space would be appropriate for the jurisdiction of the agency. We'll hear more about that case. Again, Seven County Infrastructure Coalition from the Supreme Court, coming out probably in May or June. A major environmental case argued just this past week before the highest court of our land. When we come back, some additional commentary about something going on again in New York and the East Coast having to do with the administration of law and justice.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Ho ho, the holidays are here, and it's time to pick a present from the grown-up gift list with Civic Media's statewide text to win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of the grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on the grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win in the statewide contest. Ho ho ho!
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Robot vacuums still frighten me, but you could win one as part of the grown-up gift list text to win contest. Shane Matinair is here. Where are you on robot vacuums?
Probably no. Yeah. My husband and I bought a Shark. If I could love a little appliance, I love my Shark vacuum.
When something actually sucks the way that you want it to, that's a good thing.
That is a good thing.
Well, look at the time here.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning 6 until 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus Law Review, our final segment of this, our weekend program, finishing up a little bit on the Supreme Court, not only the things that it did do, these oral arguments of the past week, but things it did not do. A couple of things on its docket that it got rid of among those 49 cases. You may recall well that from time to time we've talked about this process whereby the Supreme Court, as it did in the previous term with respect to one of the so-called abortion cases, finds that its grant of the writ of certiorari was improvidently granted. Improvidently granted is the language the Supreme Court uses when it takes a look at the docket, all the materials given to it by the lower court, and says, you know what, after all, turns out we don't have enough here to decide the case. We should not have granted this. There's something about the jurisdiction. There's something about the facts, the law that prompts us to say, oops, we need to send this back. We should not be reviewing this anymore, and we are not going to issue a substantive decision on it. Did that with respect to two cases this past week, both of which were fairly significant. One of them involving Facebook and a question of whether or not securities fraud is part of the recent history of the Facebook leadership. Question is whether risk disclosures of false or misleading information, whether those disclosures pose a risk that are material and the impacts of those risks upon the shareholders, future business harm, all kinds of things related to false representations and the misleading nature of them, not finding that they were in fact misleading, but the standards to be used, the Supreme Court, in a case called Facebook versus Amalgamated Bank, again, indicating the financial nature of this, says in the end, we've taken a look at this and we've determined that this question about whether or not the Facebook company defrauded shareholders when it filed a form with the SEC indicating the misuse of its personal data, whether all of that should be considered, what we make sense of that, risks and so forth. We don't have enough to decide that case. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit allowed the suit to go forward, and the Supreme Court now saying, yes, we're going to send it back to the Ninth Circuit. Improvidently granted, the Ninth Circuit decision stands, and the lawsuit against Facebook, again, we haven't heard the last of the case itself, but that will go back to the Ninth Circuit and the district court there, presumably for a trial or some other disposition. Supreme Court not going to be weighing in on this securities case involving Facebook and the things involving the hypothetical risks, the real risks, the effects of the company and on its shareholders of alleged misrepresentations in the presentation of some of the interests of that company. Facebook versus Amalgamated Bank, not going to be decided by the Supreme Court, doing the same thing as well in a case called NVIDIA Corp versus Omen, And that case also a case in which the Supreme Court took a look at it and said improvidently granted. In that particular case, a company was arguing the Ninth Circuit had deepened a split among the courts of appeals and created a second split. It contended that only one court of appeals agreeing with a Ninth Circuit ruling on the knowledge of wrongdoing. Five other circuits have held that plaintiffs seeking to plead knowledge based upon internal company documents must plead that with particularity, the actual contents of those documents. There's a question about how you plead a case involving representations and those kinds of things in a civil case, again, involving civil litigation and the pleadings at an initial stage. The court, as a part of its review of this, seeming wanting to resolve this issue, split in the circuits, Ninth Circuit, and opinions from two other courts about whether or not a plaintiff's expert opinion can substitute for particularized allegations of falsity in a complaint. Lots of civil procedure there, lots of trial procedure there. The Supreme Court basically saying in a per curiam ruling, again, not particularly ascribed by any particular justice, dismissing the case as improperly granted, sending it back to the lower court and saying, you now take care of that case as well. Getting rid of some cases here based upon its decision that they should not have taken them in the first place. And finally, the Supreme Court also turning away some cases, refusing to grant certiorari, one of those cases coming out of the state of Wisconsin. In particular, a case involving some parents in the Eau Claire School District, the Eau Claire School District themselves countering claims that some gender support plans in Eau Claire that are included in a student's record, available parental use, are somehow violative of the law. The policy, school officials said, is intended to provide support to students who express concern about their gender identity. Parents taking that on and saying that those reports are hidden from parents who would disagree that it is in their child's best interest, challenging the decisions of the school district there in Eau Claire to maintain and administer these reports. The Supreme Court this past week saying, no, we're not going to review that. Supreme Court turning away the Wisconsin parents who are saying that the Eau Claire School District was hiding transgender support plans. Supreme Court not going to be taking that case, even though Sam Alito would have taken the case. He is dissenting in that matter. Supreme Court also rejecting a case coming out of Hawaii. That also leads to the final comments of our broadcast this weekend, declining to intervene or overturn a Hawaii State Supreme Court decision that allowed the state to prosecute a man for carrying a loaded pistol without a license. In 2022, of course, as we know, the Supreme Court had issued a broad gun rights decision. That was the case in Bruin. And the defendant in this case, his name is Wilson, challenged the gun charge against him. He was hiking in the West Maui Mountains when he was stopped by a property owner. He was turned over to the police and was informed that he was trespassing. Appears that he was carrying a loaded pistol. He was arrested for that and criminal charges brought against him. Mr. Wilson seeking review by the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rejecting his writ, saying, no, we're not going to review that case, keeping it in Hawaii and keeping Mr. Wilson plainly dissatisfied with what was going on there in his case. Supreme Court denying writs of certiorari in those cases as well. And finally, of course, coming out of the catastrophe in New York, the assassination on the streets of New York of the CEO Brian Thompson, one of the other unspoken, although reported on to some extent, aspects of this case is a part of the gun that the police believe was used to kill the CEO of United Healthcare. CEO was actually made by a 3D printer using a popular design found online. That, of course, hearkening back to this issue about guns generally in America, when a Glock isn't a Glock, and the history of the pistol that's found, again, attributed to the defendant, presumed innocent as always, hearkening back again to the oral argument of the Supreme Court just this past term on whether ghost guns are properly regulated by the ATF, that case Vanderstock versus Garland. All of these things connected, major Supreme Court cases and the events of our times, even things as horrific as this assassination of recent days, all of them related rule of law in America, justice in America, the administration of the law in our nation. All of that to be discussed in future editions and
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome talent manager and actress Heather Arndt and Appleton-based comedian Rob Brackenridge, who drops by the studio for some laughs. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The U.S. considers the Syrian group that ousted President Bashar Assad a terrorist organization. But Secretary of State Antony Blinken, at a meeting about Syria in Jordan, says the U.S. has been in direct contact with that group.
We've been in contact with HTS and with other parties. We have impressed upon everyone we've been in contact with the importance of finding Austin Tice and bringing him home.
Austin Tice, an American freelance journalist and Marine veteran kidnapped in Syria in 2012. President-elect Donald Trump will attend the Army-Navy football game today. There's a flight restriction in the area around the stadium in Maryland, and now authorities reminding people that is a no-drone zone as well, as New York Governor Kathy Hochul says this has gone too far. It's after drone activity shut down runways at Stewart Airport north of New York City Friday. She's calling on the federal government to strengthen drone oversight. This is ABC News.